It's Saturday, August 29th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak,
the bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
A little bit about Snow Leopard. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Al Luckow, a new media architect.
Hi.
And Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media guy. And what else do you do?
Don't put me on the spot like that. Too much. I don't know.
You're not working at Stanford anymore.
I don't even know what I do. No, I'm not working at Stanford anymore.
But you're available to go to people's homes and help them with their computers?
Yeah, sure.
All right, sure. And I'd let Ben in my home. In fact, I let you in my home last night. You stayed in my place last night.
Yeah, indeed. Great. Indeed.
All right, let's start up with the show with some robots. Al?
Ooh, this one's good because people have been talking about this one. A couple of our listeners, Robert and Nestor, both emailed me the story, and it's been in the news, and this is an amazing thing. It's a robot hand that it's got like three fingers, and it can do literally anything.
A hand can do?
Yeah. It's by the Ishikawa Komuro Lab. And it has there's this YouTube video, and it shows it doing all these impressive things of dexterity and manipulation. It spins a pencil between its fingers. It plays ping pong. It throws a ball. It ties knots. It takes a cell phone and throws it up in the air and catches it.
It ties knots?
Yeah, it ties knots. It can pick up a grain of rice with tweezers and then like move it and put it down and then keep picking it up. And you think, oh, well, these are kind of interesting things. But when you see this robot hand do it, it does it like lightning fast. Like,
yeah.
You know, like so fast. Like the ping pong ball. You know how you're... It's like that fast.
Yeah,
it's
dribbling
like,
with two of its fingers.
With little pads on the fingers. Just unreal.
Yeah, this is one of those things, you know, every week you bring up these great robot news stories, and lots of times I haven't seen the video, and of course you can't watch it while we're doing the show because
right,
it'd
yeah.
be distracting.
Yeah.
And oh, like that.
Yeah.
And so this week I actually caught this news story earlier in the week and watched it. I'm like, this is amazing. And it's hard to describe on radio what this thing can do, but the speed of it's creepy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and one of the things you know, you always see with robotic hands is they seem to be very... robotic.
Yeah.
And this thing seems more elegant and natural in some ways.
Right.
I mean, it's creepy because it's moving so fast, but one of the things it does is that spins that pencil basically between two fingers or three fingers really. And just the idea that it's not completely grasping the object but can allow it to move around is the kind of dexterity that I've always perceived as something that humans have.
And it can sense.
That robots don't.
Like
but
picking up a grain of rice, you know, and so.
Like, how can it know?
We were talking about this earlier about if you had. If we built one, I mean, this thing exists. I mean, it's amazing. You see the video, you go, wow, that's incredible. It's scary. If you had a hand that we could build that was so great that could do all these crazy things.
And really fast.
Really fast. Is there the temptation to say, well, you know, I would like one of those hands instead of my hand?
Right.
You know, would you say, okay, well, remove my hand and put this thing on because it's so much better? You know, where are we in that sense, you know, where people would say, I want to be augmented. You know, I think John Tracy brought this up in
yeah, he says, I foresee a time soon where mechanical limbs will be too tempting with speed, strength, agility, and usefulness that keeping our meat arms will make no sense. To be competitive in a productive market, you'll need afterbirth upgrades.
I know. I was like, you crush your hand and you look at this ability to upgrade your hand, right?
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of like what happens with computers.
Well, it's not if you crush your hand. It's like, my hand is just my meat hand.
Not nearly as efficient.
Not quite as good as I want it to be. And I'm a ping pong player or something. You know,
or I'm a car mechanic.
Yeah.
You know, just like, you don't have to have tools anymore. You just have your hand.
Yeah. And just, I mean, is there going to come a time we're going to just say, I want one of those robot hands instead of my hand? I mean, is that ever going to happen? Are we going to like look at that and say we can
really
be better
do
with
that.
This thing? And it's not. I'm not talking about your arm got injured or cut off in an accident. I'm talking about like a conscious decision. You know, will we ever get to that?
I hope I'm never at the point where I want to do that.
That's really terrifying. Mm-hmm. By the way, I hope this arm. I haven't seen the video. I hope this arm is attached to a wall or something.
Okay, currently,
like something that can't move right
currently
now.
It just comes out of a pile of goo on the floor. No, it's actually it's actually mounted. It's large.
Because,
yeah, you can't put it on right now. Right?
These robots, if these robots ever talk to each other, we're toast.
Oh, you heard about the swarm last week. They do talk to each other.
Yep.
All right. Let's do Ben. Ben, go ahead and talk to me about
bad news.
Speaking of bad news.
I want to talk about something fictitious.
Okay.
At least in my opinion, UFOs, unidentified flying objects. And what's funny to me about UFOs is that their name is UFOs, unidentified flying objects.
So you've identified them.
And yet we use the word to describe alien spacecraft, things that we are sure are aliens visiting us from another world, when in fact maybe they just might be, maybe at the furthest end of the spectrum, ball lightning, but maybe at the other end of the spectrum, the moon. People actually do,
Or how about the more common one? Tired. The person was tired.
Tired plus airplane equals aliens? What? Occam's razor, right? And of course, with UFOs, there's no good compelling evidence that we are being visited by aliens. The Roswell story has become something it never actually was. The videos are grainier. They're found to be fakes. Eyewitness testimony is completely useless because of the fallibility of human memory. Well, they found that there actually is a correlation, imagine this, between UFO sightings and UFO movies being released. It turns out that Independence Day was released in 1996. And in 1995, before Independence Day was released, there were 117 sightings that were reported. In 1996, there were 609 sightings.
Hmm.
That's interesting. It's like a quintupling of the number.
So the question is, why is that movie so compelling for our alien visitors to come watch?
I don't know.
You know, like, so they hear that the aliens hear that we have a really good movie called Independence Day, and they come and see it.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, why the increase in robotic sightings.
Of course.
And this is true. I'm assuming they looked at a large history of popular movies with aliens in them, and then looked at how much there seems to be a correlation.
There seems to be a correlation for at least some of it. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when that was at the peak of popularity, there were tons of UFO sightings. Actually, more UFO sightings than there ever have been. There were somewhere around 760 UFO sightings yearly.
And a lot of people playing that piano.
These are recorded by the
EPs. Can you play that on the piano, Ben?
Yeah, well, let's wheel it in.
It's actually right behind you. That's
now it is. The interesting thing about E.T. actually is there was a decrease in the number when E.T. was released.
Because everybody wants to love it. They don't get scared.
Yeah. I mean, we could always make our theories fit the data.
All right. Well, that's kind of cool.
But the other important, or the other interesting thing I found was right after September 11th, the number of UFO sightings cut in half from around 200 recorded by this org to 100 for the next 3, 4, 5 years almost. And now they're just starting to go up again to maybe their average of maybe around 250.
It's so fun to hear these figures and go, oh, well, what's the reason, and try to figure out some off-the-cuff idea. Like I'd imagine that when you see some light in the sky, instead of thinking it's an alien after 9/11, you might think it's a terrorist. Like there might be a different fear-based mechanism that kicks in that overrides the UFO unknown thing.
Yeah, perhaps.
Anyway, but
it's not as newsworthy. I mean, 2001 and 2002 and maybe even 2003, there was so much news on September 11th, even years after the fact, that UFOs just weren't as interesting anymore to report on. So perhaps they just weren't in our collective consciousness.
Well, thank you very much. But speaking of interesting things to report on, Al, robots climbing?
Yeah. I do have a comment on that. I mean, everybody knows that aliens just move way too fast to be photographed.
Yeah, that's actually why
they're moving around at light speed. You can possibly have a picture.
Or no, they move so fast that the only images you can get are very, very, very blurry.
That's the distinction.
Yeah, there are these robots. We've talked about climbing robots before. that can climb telephone poles, little things, which is a little scary. But
you know, that that of all the different stories you've done over the last 6 months or so on robots doing creepy things, the climbing robot, the telephone climbing robot, always creeps me out. Because one of the ideas is, if I'm being chased by something, I can climb because I'm, you know, the whole primate thing, and therefore I can get away. You know, even like a bear, you can climb away from a bear if you get a tree. So the idea that, oh yeah, these robots do this and this and this. Okay, they climb. What do I do with that?
and that one was.
Of course, if they climb, they climb faster than we can.
Right, and that's why spiders, I think, freak people out a lot, because they can climb
up walls.
Okay. So this is another climber?
Yeah, this particular one doesn't require, the other one requires being able to grip, you know, a pole. This one uses, it can go straight up a flat wall, all right? And they've already kind of worked on things like this for, like, geckos. And things like that, you know, using the kind of gecko type of thing.
Right.
The problem with that sort of technology, and the same thing about the gecko, is the feet are always sticky. All right?
Right.
So you can't really turn it off. This new thing is called electroadhesives, and it uses electrostatic force generated between high voltage electrodes on the robot and the surface substrate.
This still like with little tiny hairs kind of effect, right? Still a little tiny things that touch. But when the electrostatic charge isn't there, they don't have that effect of gripping.
Right. So
very cool.
So this can be turned off and on, and it can go up and down and do all these things and lift it up. It's being developed by researchers at SRI International, formerly called Stanford Research Institute.
What does this thing look like? Does it have wheels, or
does it have feet? A pad.
Okay.
It's just, you know, directly on the feet.
Okay.
It says it can support 0.2 to 1.4 N per square centimeter.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
Requiring a mere 20 microwatts per Newton. This means that a square meter of electroadhesive could hold at least 200 kilograms. 440 pounds for those of us who...
That's a big foot, though, square meter.
Yeah. Yeah, that's big. Well, only consuming 40 milliwatts.
Oh, wow.
And it could turn off and on at the flick of a switch.
Oh, nice.
So...
But so if I need... For my body weight, I almost need... Well, I need less than that. But let's say a square meter. That's a lot of surface area. That's...
Well, I mean...
But the idea that you don't have to, like, pump things. You just have to, like, push a little button.
You
could definitely climb... Can it do glass?
It doesn't say that it can't do glass. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you thought you could get away by climbing a pole, but now you can't even get away if you're, like, climbing up a sheer cliff because the thing can just, you know, can just go right up there. So there's no escape. You've got these robot hands coming after you.
So the only thing we have is swimming.
Swimming.
Right?
Yep.
No, because the best swimmers on the planet are submersibles that are robotically controlled.
They can go deep, but how...
How fast can they go?
Yeah. That we'll have to look into.
Probably faster.
If you merged all our robot technology and made a robot that could do that,
it would be very,
and mated it with a shark, we'd be toast.
And it would be very, very heavy.
That's true.
So that is what we have.
Right. Oh, I see.
If we made all of
surface water living, that's where all humans will be in a few hundred years.
If it had an inflatable balloon, then we'd be in trouble because it could just float.
But you can pop a balloon
or give it stairs.
Made of what's it called, Tevlar or something? The bulletproof vest material.
What we just have to do is we have to design our infrastructures and our cities and everything right now, thinking about how to escape from robots. We have to design everything.
Stairs a lot.
Yeah,
I actually just saw a YouTube video with that Honda Akimbo robot.
Yes.
You know, the one that walks around. They have it now where it doesn't have to be tethered.
Right,
and they show it in front of this big audience.
We're talking about it's like a bipedal humanoid looking robot. For a long time, it's had like a big apparatus coming out of its back to kind of hold it up, make sure it doesn't fall over.
Mm-hmm.
And now that just is gone.
Yeah, so they can have
it's like for a while. It's like, oh, it's safe. It's like, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay, now it's a completely autonomous robot.
It looks a lot like one of the spacemen from like the Apollo mission. It's got like a big helmet like that, and it walks around. And they show it in front of this audience, and it was somebody filming, and the robot is like doing all these things, and they're just telling it. It's now able to understand speech, so you can say these things. And they say, you know, they do it all in Japanese. They say, go walk up these stairs. So then the robot goes and starts walking up the stairs. It gets to like one of the top stairs, and Oh, it falls down, and everybody in the audience is, you know, and all this Chinese or Japanese talk going on like that, and then a couple guys run out there and they take out this big screen and put it in front of the robot, and they have to
a modesty screen,
like a modesty screen, and it was the funniest thing.
Add it to the show.
I think that was a couple of years ago, actually.
Yeah, what happens when someone's talking to the robot and you're like, you and I are going, oh, well, give it a command, okay, tell it to jump, okay. Well, could we tell it to attack humans, and then it gets us. I mean, it's right. So dangerous.
Well, it's that whole three robot law.
Yeah, they need but they don't have it. They're not smart enough to understand the three robot law. So anyway, if robots are chasing you and you need to get away, and your infrastructure is designed really well, exit doors have to be thought about.
Yes, indeed, exit doors do have to be thought about. Well, I actually have a beautiful segue. I have a story talking about emergency exits and how counterintuitively. If you put obstacles, if you're designing an emergency exit and you put an obstruction by the exit in a certain way, it actually will increase the number of people who can exit. And I'm not talking about like putting a couch in front of the door or something.
Talking about like putting like a triangle so that there's like a flow or something.
Specifically, it was University of Tokyo in Japan. They did some research, and
I love the idea of doing research on getting people out of a building. So you get a whole bunch of undergrads, you sit them in a room, you give them a test for about 10 minutes, get them nice
and
relaxed,
set something
and you
on fire,
run, y'all run out of the room. Yeah, and you record the whole thing. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and then people get concussions, and you know, it's fun, right? All good. Fun for everyone.
All science should have concussions. Yeah.
Well,
so they found that if you block the door,
their computer prediction said that if you put a pole that's about the width of a person, about 30 degrees to either the left or right side of an exit door, that will actually speed up the exit of the people because there will be fewer people. Conflicting with each other, like crashing into each other, leaving the exit door.
Right. That makes sense. So if you got 30 people in a room and a flat wall and a door in the middle of it, and everybody runs up, you could get 6 people kind of trying to go to the door at the same time, kind of bumping each other.
It's like those children's games where you're trying to fit all the marbles down the hall, and the marbles are hitting against each other.
So you just need a slot with one of those little posts, so people kind of bang into things.
Yeah, if there's a little post, then all the marbles will orient themselves in more of a line, right?
Right. So basically, you're talking about spreading out or backing up the intersection of the people would make it more efficient.
Organizing it more, yeah.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, they're going to organize themselves, but if you give them an obstacle that's
they'll
close,
organize more quickly.
They'll organize before they get to the problem.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
very cool.
Exactly.
Okay, thanks.
So they'll be like exit poles.
So, and those could have, those could also have tasers to stop robots. Oh, no, you can't stop robots with tasers.
No.
They're more powerful. They just absorb the energy.
Maybe what we could do is make those poles actually robots, and then it can help people.
And the robots.
Through.
No. Yeah, I was thinking, make the poles robots and they'll like knock out any robots that come near.
It's perfect.
But what if the robots collude with the poles? Maybe slip them some money, maybe a $20 bill.
It's a bad sci-fi show waiting to happen.
Oh, bad news.
So, all right. And, okay.
I don't know about you guys. I'm terrified.
I was going to try to do a segue to your story about being able to see without eyes, but I don't know how to do it at this point, so I'll just do it blatantly like that. Please.
Well, if you can't see, then you might have an opportunity to be able to see with your tongue. This is the most amazing thing, and I often think about my visions because I rely so heavily on it, and who doesn't? But if you lost your vision, you hear about all these people that can, like, you know, they can really smell and, you know, hear and all
others,
that.
Yeah,
but I'm always thinking, well, you know, that would really still be kind of a bummer. But there is a device, and it's experimental, that can simulate vision through your tongue. And it sounds too bizarre to be true. And that's what I thought. That's why I thought, I got to check this out. But it actually makes a lot of sense when you watch the video and you look at the documentation. Pardon the pun. Makes a lot of sense. Anyway, it turns out Brainport Vision is developing this technology that actually does enable a blind person to see with his tongue. And they have a video there on their website, and they show it being used by this guy, Eric Weinmayer, a man who's lost all his vision. And he's got a little camera mounted on his head. It's a small video camera that translates visual information to like a credit card sized tongue display. It's got
I can't get a credit card in my mouth.
Well,
it's smaller than a credit card, but go on.
It's got 400 tiny pixels that present electrical patterns on this guy's tongue. And then his brain interprets it as a visual picture in three-dimensional space. So he can actually use the device to read words and numbers on note cards. He can play tic-tac-toe and stone, paper, scissors with his daughter. And there's actually a thing with him showing him rock climbing, you know, with a harness
and all that. We're basically talking about touch at a distance. Because the tongue, it'd be kind of equivalent to you being able to go and touch stuff with your hands and produce a mental picture to some degree. So this is the tactile sensations happening on the tongue.
Right. Well, there's Braille and stuff like that. But the thing about Braille is that you have to feel it.
Right.
And then you've got to figure out what the letter is. And then you've got to keep feeling a few more. And then you've got to reinterpret it as to that being a word. And there's all this stuff.
So the camera idea of being able to do this at a distance, we've heard studies about this over the years of GeekSpeak. We've talked about this a bit, this idea, but it's a very compelling thing that only works, of course, because most brains are designed to be able to do sight. Mm-hmm. Because without that brain function, it would be very difficult to do this.
Well, you see with your brain, not your eyes.
That's very good. Very well said.
Right, yeah.
It's a hard thing to explain to people that your eyes are just this massive data stream going into your brain. Your brain's actually the one that goes, okay, what the heck does all this mean? And that part of the brain that can do that could theoretically do that with any kind of input.
Right.
In fact, I think we did this with there was a study with chest sensor kind of thing or other devices. The basic idea is that as you move back and forth, the same pattern emerges over and over again, and the brain pretty soon goes, oh, that's talking about the space outside of me.
Right.
That's what that thing is. It's some kind of input outside, and that's how the tongue...
Well, I think the tongue has just got a lot of sensors on it. It's like a very sensitive thing, and if you have this like thing, and it's putting these... The picture that the guy's getting, it's like a mosaic. Imagine a real high contrast bitmap sort of image. Mm-hmm. So he's seeing that kind of thing, but with some level of variance. You know, you could probably get some level of grayscale within there to show dimension. And, I mean, she's playing tic-tac-toe with his daughter. You know, he can see the images and the shapes and things like that, which is, you know, I wonder
This was someone that grew up with sight and then lost vision because of his eyes.
Yes, he lost his
vision. He does have the brain structure designed really well for sight, and therefore there was a void for it.
Mm-hmm. So he
I think that's a part of these systems working.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have that brain structure from early on, it doesn't necessarily develop. For example, I don't have parallax ability. I can't use both my eyes at the same time produce 3D images. I switch between my two eyes. Mm-hmm. And because of that, even if my eyes were aligned perfectly, I still have trouble. I still can't do it because my brain wasn't trained at an early age to do it. In any case, fascinating stuff. And this I'm assuming driving would be out of the picture at this point.
Well, at this point, it's experimental. So, but it's so exciting to think about. You know, you always think about your eyes and vision, and what would happen if, you know, and here's something that actually does appear to give vision back to somebody, you know, and it bypasses the eyes.
Now, here's something that kind of is interesting to me. We talk about the different senses that we have, and we can speak about them with analogy. I mean, you and I can speak about color pretty effectively, even though we don't necessarily see the same color. Mm-hmm. But we can talk about those attributes well with language. When you talk to someone who's never seen anything before, talking about sight is kind of ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
So if you talk to this guy about what it's like to see with his tongue, it's not like what we see, but it's not like what anybody sees. He has a completely unique experience that... Can he use language to communicate what that experience is?
Right.
I don't know.
He'd probably have to take the tongue thing off if he wanted to use language.
Very good. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Okay. See, Henry would be able to understand that guy with the tongue thing on his mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's a dentist. And dentists can, like, understand when your tongue doesn't move and you talk.
He'd be able to get
I don't know, about $4.
What? I always wonder, though, how much of it is just them predicting what you're probably saying.
Right, right.
Because I remember when I was a kid and I used to say things that maybe they wouldn't have predicted me saying, you know, very geeky things. Mm. And they would respond with the most baffling, like, I'm like, how... That doesn't make any sense. Maybe they didn't understand me.
At what revolutions per second is your drill functioning?
Yeah.
Oh, you like the Yankees? What?
No.
Right. All right. What's a good – Al, you got a good podcast?
Oh, yeah. We're talking about bringing up podcasts every now and then. And this particular one is called Scam School Social Engineering. This is a really neat – it's a video podcast, so you'll download it and you'll watch it on either your video iPod or device or on your computer. And, of course – as always, these podcasts are free. They have new episodes on Thursday. It's by this guy who's this magician, Brian Brushwood. He's also written a couple of books, The Professional's Guide to Fire Eating, Pack the House, and Cheats, Cons, Swindles, and Tricks. But what this podcast is they're about, you know, 4 to 10 minutes long, to vary. And he shows you all these bar tricks, you know, when people like tear a napkin in half and say, you know, watch this or, you know, do this. This guy sits there and he goes through, he shows you how to open padlocks, escape from handcuffs, escape from thumb cuffs, win at rock, paper, scissors every time, read minds, lots of card tricks, things like that. It's really, you know, it's almost like I don't even want to tell people about this podcast because it would mean, you know, now I, you know, they're telling them all the secrets, but, you know, and I'm not as popular, but if you're ever interested in this kind of thing, it's really cool. Just all these neat little bar tricks that you can do, and it's really baffling. And since it's video, you can actually learn how to – he explains how to do them in detail. So
that's called Scam School Social Engineering. And find all the stuff we talk about on GeekSpeak. Go up to our website, geekspeak.org. Every show, we produce a big page of notes and features and URLs and all the stuff we've been talking about published up on the show for the show page. So, and to find the shows that we're talking about, you got to have to listen to the show, and then you can find the titles. The titles are always kind of named based on the show. In any case, that's geekspeak.org. Again, geekspeak.org. Today, we do not have Rick in the house, so we're not taking phone calls. But we, of course, at geekspeak.org, will take emails and take forum posts. You can post forum stuff there. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. All right, I believe that we were just talking about blind tongue seeing. So we're going to go ahead and go to other amazing things. Ben, what's going on astronomically with other planets? We're finding planets left and right now.
We are, yes. Tons of exoplanets. Pretty exciting stuff. And, of course, Kepler just went live, so we're going to be discovering all kinds of stuff with Kepler, I'll bet, as well. But this story is pretty interesting. We've discovered this planet, which is known as a hot Jupiter. It's very big. It's a gas giant, and it's orbiting the star WASP-18. I know. I was just – anyway.
So what is it doing? So cool.
Very nostalgic. I grew up over there. it's about 330 light years away from Earth. And here's the trick, though. That the planet is actually so close to the star that it completes a full orbit. Its year, like for us, we complete an orbit in a year. It completes a full orbit in less than one Earth day.
That's a close
and it's
planet.
A gas giant. It's huge. So
wait a second. One day on a that's moving quite fast, and that
really,
has to be really close to the gravity body. Wouldn't they be kind of interacting with each other and slowing down and stuff?
Well, yes. Yeah. And that is called...
decay?
What's that called? Orbital drag.
Orbital drag, yeah.
Yeah. And so here's the problem, though, is that the star is believed to be about 1 billion years old, and the planet's about 1 billion years old as well. According to our current science, the orbit from this planet should decay over the course of about 1 million years. So the likelihood of us seeing it is very low. And so we're trying to figure out how is this possible that we're seeing this, because this orbit should have been decaying or should be decayed and the planet should be further out or it should be gone or, you know, something. So there are a couple of possibilities. Douglas P. Hamilton wrote a commentary on this. He's an astronomer at the University of Maryland. And he said that the possibilities are the star is about 1,000 times less energetic. So there's much less orbital drag on the planet. That's a possibility. But that means that we need to maybe
But then why is it so bright?
Well, yeah, right, and we also have to reconsider all of our knowledge about internal star.
So that's probably
formation.
Not it.
Well, it could be.
It could be.
Another possibility is the planet hasn't been in position for very long. Maybe it was bumped out of its original orbit by a really large
within
body.
Within the last million years.
Yeah, exactly. And so somehow it got there.
Couldn't it also just be that the sun is actually a Dyson sphere and therefore it doesn't have as much atmospheric interference with the... No?
No.
Oh, okay. Because then it wouldn't be bright.
Oh,
it would be dark.
Oh, UFOs again.
Actually, I want to say... Yeah,
the third possibility is that we're just simply missing something. Something big it's glaring.
Here seems to be a relatively simple idea. If every once in a while a planet does this because it gets hit by a foreign body, the reason why we don't normally like to think about that in science is that most of the time in our history of science, if we say we're in a special time right now, we're normally wrong, right? So if we see something, we go, oh, it's because we got lucky and we're in a special time... normally that's not true. Normally we didn't figure something out. Yeah. So that's why they go, well, it could be in the 1 million year window right now that planets somehow got moved. But that means we're in a special time for this system. Except that the way we find planets has to do with wobble of the star. And this thing is going to be wobbling like a like hotcakes, right?
Yeah.
So not that hotcakes wobble that much. But the idea that that would be something we'd find quicker than other things that are moving slower, therefore, is a higher probability we're going to find something in that window of 1 million years.
Yeah, I'm curious if the – I don't know actually know where they got their data from, either star wobble or Kepler. Probably too soon for Kepler to be released in any studies. But I'd be interested to see if they can – you know, if it's any more illuminating if we use Kepler. But anyway, yeah, so we might be missing something really important and we might need to completely rethink
here's the thing.
Our internal star. Right.
So this is the kind of stuff that physicists just love when they find something kind of unusual and unique. But why aren't physicists doing more for us every day?
Oh, they are.
What do you mean?
They are. Oh, there are some really fantastic things that physicists are doing. And this is one of them. They have created the perfect coffee mug.
Oh, see, I like coffee, so that excites me. Is it blue?
Well,
then it's not perfect.
It's sort of a...
Sorry.
This one is from the Fraunhofer Institute. Scientists have invented the perfect coffee mug, one that absorbs the heat from your beverage, making it go down to a perfect temperature, and then releasing it slowly to keep it at that exact temperature for 30 minutes.
So there's some material inside the cup that has a special temperature.
The trick to this is it's called PCM, phase.
Wait, it keeps the coffee hot for 30 minutes?
Yes, yes. It's because of this phase change material, an extraordinary substance used in construction and winter clothing.
Okay.
It's capable of storing and releasing hot or cold. In its original state, it's solid. But when it receives heat, it absorbs it like a sponge and it liquefies into this like gooey wax.
Uh-huh.
And as the PCM solidifies, you know, after it's being waxed, going back to solid form, it releases the energy at a steady pace, keeping any liquid or room, actually, at the perfect temperature. They
want to
do this
cool.
with houses, too.
Man, new materials are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every time you hear about a new material, like, that's incredible. The idea that you can go, let's just superheat this thing. Okay, mm-hmm. hotter, actually just gets more liquidy. It doesn't actually change temperature very much. It absorbs most of the heat. And then as it solidify. So the temperature is not going to be burning you. It's
right.
going to be like a good temperature.
That's the thing. It also brings it down to the right temperature. It's the whole thing. It's made of hollow ceramics, and inside there's like an aluminum structure, which gets filled with this phase change material.
You do not want to microwave this cup. Go on.
Yeah, you know that's an interesting problem.
Well, you don't need to. You don't need to reheat it.
Yeah. Right. Well, when you pour your hot coffee in, the heat, you know, is gets absorbed, reaching the personal optimum level based on the amount of that
mixture.
PCM stuff that's in there. So
cool.
you can actually order the cup
for like 98, 97,
exactly.
107.
And I mean, according to Klaus Seidbauer, the head of this Fraunhofer Institute, you can totally customize the cup. They say the perfect cup keeps it at 136.4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, really? I didn't know how hot a good hot is.
Well,
I want one of these really bad. Can you give them a call and get one?
Well, the pictures that they show of the thing, it doesn't say, you know, world's best dad on it or anything. It's pretty ugly looking.
And does it fit in the coffee holder in your car? Probably not.
Oh, yeah. It's a regular coffee cup. It just looks kind of industrial-like.
I love industrial.
It looks like a testing prototype model.
Yeah.
It's got stuff hooked up to it.
Uh-huh. But cool. You know, I mean, finally. And then physicists
warm.
Are coming up with this kind of thing. It's
Or cool.
Yeah. So there we have it. The world's best coffee cup.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep.
All right.
I want to see when that gets to market.
I'm Al, thank you. And Ben, thank you. And Miles. Wait. There is no Miles today.
Ooh,
which means we're not covering political stuff. Does anyone have a political story?
I have a one. I'm just going to cover it briefly, which is that.
Thank you. Can I call you Miles while you do it?
That I feel weird about.
Okay.
I'm sorry. But yeah, so U.S. government employees and contractors, they are subject to a mandatory annual information security briefing.
And oh, that sounds like seat gripping.
Yeah, I would be marking my calendar, just waiting for it, counting down the days,
hoping for the flu.
Well. This year, the briefing states that all downloaded music is stolen.
Oh.
Period.
That's what...
Yes.
Is that actually the phrase of the training session?
Yeah. Well, this according to Slashdot, it's actually a flash site, which means that I would probably have to sit there for 45 minutes going through their training to get to this question. But according to the story, it says, quote, according to the material, the correct response to an employee who is downloading music is to shout, "That's stealing." So that's what it says.
Now and the reason why you and I are probably very sensitive to this issue because, of course, it's not always. We're aware very much that people give away music for free.
Well, yeah, I'm a musician. A public domain works. I mean,
and you can
Creative
say,
Commons.
You know, download it for free as much as you want. That's valid. And
more
so
free licenses.
Government's kind of missing that idea that actually sometimes when you're downloading music, it's not stolen. It's actually given away, and that's okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're downloading a Britney Spears album, then it's probably stolen because she's, you know.
Not giving it away.
Yeah, exactly.
But you don't actually know until you look at the copyright.
Yeah, I mean, didn't Radiohead release?
Yeah, several bands have done this.
They've
offered it for free, and they said, "Please give donations if you can.
Give what you want.
Give
what you want to pay.
Right. Or you know, go donate money to somebody else. You know, that kind of thing. So, it's definitely a misnomer. The idea that all music downloads are illegal.
Yeah, and what's worse is that this is a government-wide training package.
But it's probably
hundreds of thousands of people.
It's probably going to be repaired.
It probably will, but that's kind of a really huge glaring error.
Yeah, it's kind of depressing to think of that's the default state. You know, what you're doing is illegal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, BitTorrent, you know, like it's such a great technology if you use it for distributing legally.
If you do it for good and not for evil.
Yeah, like Linux distros and things like that. I mean, a lot of BitTorrent clients update themselves using that protocol. It makes so much sense, but it's used for nefarious purposes most of the time. So therefore, it's evil.
And I got to say, it's kind of depressing that so many people have the wrong idea about how things are. Like, can anybody cheer me up? I'm getting a little bummed. But thank you, Ben, for the story.
Sorry.
I could think of a way to cheer you up unless you're been looking at the internet too long.
Okay. Well, I was actually digging for a different story, Al. But we can do the internet one. No, let's wait on the internet one. We got a little bit more time.
Okay.
The one I was thinking of is Thinking of Yesterday.
Yeah.
And can make you happier.
Yes.
Yeah.
Apparently, thinking of yesterday can make you happier today. So the best way that,
like literally yesterday or yesterday in the metaphorical means.
Well, I think they say the day before. Yeah. It says, the best way to make yourself feel happier is to think of something good that happened to you the day before.
Oh.
This is
an
experiment.
So literally yesterday. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay.
It was a mass participation experiment conducted by Professor Richard Wiseman at the Hertfordshire University.
That sounds like it's in England.
You know what? It must be, yeah.
Okay.
And it's in a UK thing that I found this. And they got 26,000 people to go online and try this selection of mood boosting techniques, and the one that came out is thinking of something great that happened that made you happy the day before.
But isn't that also just akin to saying, okay, you want to feel happier? Think of something great.
Well, they said, you know, like an act of kindness led to like a 9% boost in happiness, while being grateful for an aspect of life led to 8%.
Specifically of something that was
something the day before that made you happy. It appears to be the most effective technique. Compared to those in the control group, this quick and simple procedure provided an additional 15% boost in happiness.
Interesting. I think I do that.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
You just think of something that happened the day before, and that's how you can make yourself happier.
Very cool.
Yep.
I didn't mention a few minutes ago when we took our little mid-show break that this is Geek Speak on KUSP, and my name's Lyle Troxell. Just speaking a moment a second ago, it's Al Luckow. Al Luckow is a new media architect, and we also have Ben Jaffe in the house today. Hey, Ben.
Hey.
And Ben, it's your turn.
Oh, it is.
Firefox? Or no, it's my turn. Oh, my gosh. So excited.
Yeah. Hey, Lyle, do you have any news stories?
Oh, thank you, Ben. Yes, I do. Charlie, who actually produces Dr. Dawn, which is the fantastic radio show right before us, Charlie mentions that he uses Firefox a lot, and he upgraded to recent Firefox 3.5, which is the most recent version, and there's a lot of compatibility issues with add-ons. Add-ons are extensions and improvements to the application, the Firefox browser, that allows you to do different things. And some of the add-ons are themes just to make the colors different. Some of them are integrating Flickr or other services into the browser more closely. They're really great features, but when a new release happens, it takes a while for all these people that produce these small application add-ons to get them upgraded to work with the new version. So right now, 3.5 just kind of breaks everybody.
You built one.
I did?
Yeah, the Geek Speak headline thing?
That's true. That's kind of, it's not an extension, but it's similar. Yeah. So Charlie was kind of frustrated. He wanted to go 3.5, but he wanted to use some themes. He started looking around, and he found a great post on how you can actually edit most of the add-ons simply by editing one file inside there. And it's kind of a complicated process, but basically it's most of them are jars or archives XML. Of Java. And that's really a zip file. And you can open that file up, and inside there's an RFD document. You edit that just saying instead of the uppermost version number is 3, you just change it to 3.5, and then you install it, and then it works. So really, a lot of the add-ons and stuff don't really have any incompatibilities with 3.5, except for they happen to say in their definition, I only work with 3. So you change that. Kind of cool.
Hmm. I actually did that when Aperture came out, and I had 768 megs of RAM, and I didn't notice on the box that they said that you need a gig of RAM. And so when I installed it just fine, when I went to open it up, it said, sorry, you don't have enough RAM. And so I went into all of the applications on Macs, by the way, are just folders that have a bunch of files inside of them. And you can actually edit one of the, I think, .plist files.
You do a right-click or yeah. Control plus a click on an application. We'll say
show package content.
It'll open the folder and access a whole bunch of stuff. It's kind of like a res edit for older Mac.
Yeah. And it's really cool. And I found, I can't remember what it was, system.strings, I think.
Yeah.
And it says min amount of RAM. And it was set to 1 GB. So I set it to, I think, 0.768 GB, and it worked fine. So anyway.
Okay, so what else about Firefox? Some people don't like Firefox 3 in general.
Yeah, that's a special brand of people. Some people have links that they don't want visitors to see. In the most intense example, you'd be giving a PowerPoint and you hop over to Firefox and, you know, we'll just call them private links, pop up in front of hundreds of people while you're giving this PowerPoint.
So that's, when you say pop up, meaning that as you start typing a URL, it looks through all your different bookmarks and says, oh, here is geekspeak.org is something you like. So if you start typing a G, it's going to put it in there, which is a great feature unless you're doing a PowerPoint and you happen to have things that you don't want your audience to see.
Yes. So with Firefox 2.
Like pornography.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So with Firefox 2, you didn't have that problem because one of the new features in Firefox 3 in the new location bar is it caches all of your bookmarks, and it goes through them and it does a keyword search matching thing on them. So if you type in GEE, then it'll say, oh, GeekSpeak, that's one of your bookmarks. Do you want to go there? You know,
right.
Or maybe Geek Tool
and that,
for the...
And that can be really embarrassing. If you're inside in front of an audience and you're talking about how wonderful the ocean is and how you want to get rid of technology, and you start typing in something in your browser, GEE, and it shows up GeekSpeak, you're like, oh my gosh, yeah, I listen to GeekSpeak.
Yeah,
and you're really embarrassed by that. So, survey that Mozilla did... says that people have a real issue with this.
Yeah. In fact, that's actually, I think it was 25% of the people actually alluded to that being their reason for not upgrading when they were asked. You have Firefox 2 and it says, do you want to upgrade to Firefox 3? And the final pop-up that they sent, they actually had it go to a survey as well. And the people who took the survey, about 25% of them said something along those lines. And that's just the people who actually said that.
Hmm.
And, you know, people with private links, it's security by obscurity. You know, you bury it somewhere deep in the folder hierarchy and then people won't find it because it's a boring looking folder. Well, with things like Spotlight or with things like the Firefox bar,
they show up just as important.
Exactly.
How deep they are in a folder structure does not make them elusive to find. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that.
Interesting.
It seems like a lot of people spend too much time thinking about their web browser, though.
Yeah.
I guess it's an important tool. Al?
Yes. Too much time in your web browser, which brings me to my next subject here. There is a new thing just opening up in the United States, which is called the Restart Internet Addiction Recovery Program.
So when you can't get to the internet, that you can go there and they'll give you internet?
Not quite.
When you overdose on the internet.
These two Americans have opened the first U.S.-based Internet Addiction Treatment Center in Falls City, Washington.
Wow.
Falls City, Washington.
Are they getting clients?
That's actually close to Microsoft, actually. Yes.
I was
up
there in Washington.
Well, we won't ask you where you were.
But how you doing on that computer there, Ben?
Seattle.
It's a 45-day treatment center where it's kind of expensive.
Oh, yeah, Ben wouldn't be able to afford it then.
Yeah,
I'm poor.
They say they can cure people's addiction to the web.
How do you know if you're addicted to the web?
Well, they have a list here, and I'm going to read these little questions. They say signs and symptoms.
Let's all answer them.
Yes, of computer and internet gaming addiction developed by Dr. Hillary Cash, PhD of Internet Computer Addiction Services.
Okay, so we're going to do this survey to some degree, and you can play along too. Mm-hmm. If you're addicted, please let us know.
It's just 12 questions.
Yeah. Okay. How many do you have to answer yes to be addicted?
We'll find out afterwards.
Okay.
Or no to. We don't know. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, increasing amounts of time spent on computer and internet activities. I guess.
Okay.
That's
so is it increased? I don't think lately it's increased. I'm doing too much construction work, so not for me. No. I haven't increased lately.
I'd say no.
I'd say no too.
All right. But Al, you spend like 12 hours a day in front of a computer.
But it's not increasing.
It's been like that for 15 years, so it's fine.
you've had failed attempts to control your behavior.
Sure. Sure. With regards to computers?
Oh, no. Not with regards to computers.
Yeah, I think so. Last night, Ben, you said you were going to sleep, and I said, okay. And then 10 minutes later, I come upstairs, you weren't asleep, you're still on your computer.
I was reading news
That's
items.
A yes for Ben.
All right, okay. Fine. How about you, Al?
All right. I've been able to control my behavior, I think, overall. A heightened sense of euphoria while involved in computer and internet activities.
No.
Am I happier on the computer than when I'm being beaten by the sticks? I guess yes.
All right. Okay. You're craving more time on the computer and internet.
No.
Oh,
I don't think I
want to get away from it.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to turn my computer off right now.
Yeah.
I'm going home, guys. See
you. You are neglecting friends and family.
More so than normal? No. Okay. I think we're doing pretty well.
And we're doing all right so
far. Maybe it's
delusional.
Yeah. I assume
you're done on all of these, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
You're feeling restless when not engaged in the activity of the internet.
Okay, the only time I would say that is my iPhone. Sometimes, like when I'm not. No, I don't know if I feel restless. I feel restless right now.
I feel restless if I don't check my email over 12 hours.
I feel a little restless when I'm not checking the email.
Yeah. All right.
Your computer use is interfering with your job school performance. Your job / school performance.
Yeah, my job is my internet use.
Yeah, that's we're tough. This is like
we're doing okay.
Yeah,
I think
we're doing
all
right. So far.
You're feeling guilty, ashamed, anxious, or depressed as a result of your behavior from the internet.
You know, I've had times in my life where that happened. Mostly when I started playing a lot of computer games. Those are the times when I really got like I'd spend 7 hours in a night, go to sleep at 2 o'clock in the morning. All I did was play a video game, and after that, I was like, ugh, why did I waste my time on that?
Well,
game?
That's
why I stopped playing computer games.
That's like that. I think what they're trying to. I mean, I don't know if we've transcended this demographic, but they're saying, have you had changes in your sleep patterns?
Right.
That's another one.
That's true for me before, yeah.
Physical changes such as weight gain or loss, backaches, headaches, carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yeah, those are all things.
Oh, I think that's an unfair question because that could be not just internet. That could
right.
be...
Well, this now, is according to this...
Ben, I noticed that you gained some weight recently because you're not floating anymore. So...
He could use a little couple pounds
right.
on him, actually.
I weigh 126 pounds.
Yeah. And you're like 4 feet taller than me.
Yeah.
And the last one, you're withdrawing from other pleasurable activities.
Is there other pleasurable activities?
There must be something else. Yeah, I think we actually did all right
we did
on this.
Okay. They say
five or more suggest addiction.
I got to go blog this experience.
it's funny, but, internet and game addiction is something I think is real. And I think it might just be worth looking at this website just to see the videos they have under the problems category because this they show people who are like, playing World of Warcraft and they're trying to interview them and they're like really addicted and they're like they're by their computer and they just keep turning their head looking at it. And people play this. I mean, people play World of Warcraft actually has little pop-up windows that come up after like 12 hours saying, hey, you should go outside or something. they actually have a thing in there that will do that.
So if you seem to answer yes to or some of these issues actually exist, do take a look at it. Really get a feeling. Yeah. Of course, if that's the case, you're probably not listening to Geekspeak because you're probably busy being on the computer.
Unless
so
they're
if
on
you
their
know
yeah.
friend that's
if,
true
if,
for this.
If you find you've been listening to us for half an hour and you have no idea anything we said, then maybe you should,
You should probably spend more time on the internet.
But if so, you probably didn't hear that. So.
Right.
All right. Let's see. What's we got? We got in the news story, I'm assuming. We have tons this day. It's so fun. Mm-hmm. What's going on with Wikipedia?
Wikipedia now on live person entries. So entries for people who are currently still alive. Mm-hmm. Now you need an account or you will soon. I don't know if they've actually implemented
to edit live entries
right now. Yeah, to edit live person entries. And this is interesting.
That basically means we want someone responsible when you edit live entries.
So exactly.
So you don't have people.
Maybe just explain what happens on Wikipedia, because a lot of people hear the word Wikipedia and they're like, what is going on here? How does this happen? Who's editing what?
Right. So let's do a brief on Wikipedia. Wikipedia is an online
encyclopedia of sorts,
which anyone in the world can edit. And Ben's talking about a bit of a restriction in the editing. You have to have an account. But basically, you can go up there right now and go to the GeekSpeak page and make a note about some fact information about GeekSpeak to edit it. People have done this. That's why I knew that the show started in a certain date, because I went to the Wikipedia entry page to check it out, which is really cool. And a lot of facts are highly accurate because there's so many people trying to make them accurate. And how is the goodwill of individuals? So
Miles actually just corrected me via chat. It's not just – you don't need just an account. You need to be an established member with good reputation.
You need to have been doing it for a while. You need to be kind of trusted, which is actually better.
Which means – well, it's better and it's worse, because Wikipedia has always been about anyone can edit anything. And then, of course, if someone's being a spam, if someone's spamming it, then they'll get booted off of it.
Right,
and
one of the issues of this kind of pseudo-anonymous editing capabilities is that if you wanted to show misinformation about someone, it would be very easy for anyone anonymously to do that.
That's true.
And so what they're trying to do is, and because of some libel laws, doing that is considered libel. And so that I think Wikimedia's kind of – the Wikimedia organization, which actually runs Wikipedia, is doing a situation where it says, well, let's try to buffer the idea of libel issues a little bit higher in the space and make it only people that have some reputation. Yeah. I recently realized I had never actually – I created an account a long time ago before you actually needed accounts and never had an email address set to it. And I don't remember the password, so I can't log in with that account, which kind of stinks. But I welcome people. If you have a little bit of information, you know a lot about Wurlitzers, for example, go to the Wiki page, see if it's correct, and add the information. You know about scissors and how they work, go up there and see if that information is correct and add to it if you can fix it.
But there have been
only
a lot
on
of
those two things, Wurlitzers and scissors. That's it.
A lot of stories.
I know a lot about scissors.
There have been a lot of stories about how fewer and fewer and fewer people have actually been editing Wikipedia articles and not having their changes revoked. And so that's kind of going against the whole idea of what Wikipedia was supposed to originally be.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the issue that I see with it.
You know, I noticed at the end of our news, we went through all of our news very effectively. We have a couple we're not going to get to. And the very end of it says, Snow Leopard. We're going to talk about QuickTime and Snow Leopard. And guess what? The show is over. We're not going to talk about Snow Leopard. But we do have a USB of the week that Al has.
Hi, this is Al Luckow. The crazy USB device segment you're about to hear is true. I haven't changed any names since there are no names. Sometimes you need to get evidence. And then, once you get evidence, you need to examine it. How do you do that? I'll tell you how. You use the USB endoscope. What is an endoscope, you say? An endoscope is a medical device consisting of a long, thin, flexible, or rigid tube which has a light and a video camera. You've probably had one in your ear at one point. This gadget comes with several focusing rings. There's a nasal ring, a tooth ring, an ear hole ring, and a concha ring. I don't know what a concha is. You're on your own there. It magnifies 30 times, takes VGA video, and works on Vista XP and 2000. What? No Mac? Anyway, examine your evidence or explore your nasal cavity with the USB endoscope.
Well, thanks, Al, for that. I appreciate it. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with Dave Lawrence, and is used with permission. If you want to learn how to buy the endoscope or more about it, of course, you go to geekspeak.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Auto, on the web at kusp.org. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.